Coming up today, we delve into WeWork's financials, look at what's really happening with COVID-19 in North Korea, and get moderately angry about generic startup adverts. Welcome to the Wired UK podcast, your essential weekly catch-up on all the big stories in tech, science, business, and culture. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me this week are Natasha Bernal.
Hello.
Amit Kawala.
Hello.
And Matt Burgess.
Hello.
This was the week when Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg said the platform will halt the algorithm-driven recommendations of political groups. He said people don't want politics and fighting to take over their experience on the platform. The move comes after social media platforms, including Facebook, were blamed for their role in the violent storming of the US Capitol by a pro-Trump mob.
This was also the week when Norway's Data Protection Authority announced it plans to fine LGBT dating app Grindr £8.5 million, which is around 10% of Grindr's estimated global revenue. The regulator said the app had been illegally selling user data to advertisers and flouting GDPR rules.
An army of amateur traders launched a siege on Wall Street this week that has shaken up markets and left seasoned hedge funds reeling. It started with GameStop, a games retailer whose shares have been sent flying by gangs of traders coordinating moves on Reddit messaging boards. The company's shares surged 435% since Friday, bringing year-to-date gains to 1,745%.
And finally, this was the week when it was revealed that Apple secured its most profitable quarter ever in the last 3 months of 2020. The company's sales for the period totaled $111.4 billion, driven by the release of new iPhone models.
$111.4 billion in a single quarter.
Yeah, I know. It sounds like the kind of sum a Bond villain might recite as a ransom demand, doesn't it?
It almost sounds like a typo, right? It's a phenomenal sum of money. There was a figure doing the rounds that Apple's quarterly revenues now exceed the annual GDP of more than half of the world's countries. It's just such a huge company. And you would have thought that the pandemic might have slowed down the amount of investment that people were making in very expensive phones and laptops and accessories. But seemingly not. Apple goes from strength to strength. Natasha, I don't know what you think, but maybe we should ditch the stories that we were going to talk about and spend the next hour and a half really going into detail on the GameStop Wall Street story. Are you up for that?
I'm fascinated. Yeah, it's genuinely the story of the year so far, I guess, which is a bit tragic because it just shows how little entertainment we have. But yeah, watching this all unfold was hilarious. I mean, the fact that you had sort of, you know, internet aficionados taking on Wall Street and beating them at their own game, and people going, "Why? I hate the free market. It doesn't work for me anymore. You broke it." It's been pretty interesting, definitely. And watching what the fallout will be next will be very good. So, yeah.
Not interesting enough for us to talk about on the podcast, though. So we'll leave it there.
Next week. Yeah.
Yep. So what did we learn this week? Let's start with Matt Burgess.
This week, I learned that some scientists and researchers are starting to put economic values on some animals' sort of impact on the planet and the benefit they bring to the planet. And they've been particularly been doing this with elephants to begin with. So each African forest elephant, according to the International Monetary Fund, is worth $1.75 million. And that's based on the sort of service it provides to the planet. Basically, that is why they're doing this, which is a bit of a sort of like controversial way to sort of think about nature and the environment, is to show that essentially that if a poacher is killing an animal and selling its ivory, then they'll get maybe like $40,000. But basically, they're making the argument and trying to reinforce why we need to protect nature, because elephants bring so much value through sort of like economic means and also planetary gains overall.
It's a funny way to come at it, isn't it, right? That the only way that you can persuade people not to shoot an elephant to turn its tusks into trinkets is to say that it's worth nearly $2 million when it's not actually worth that, right? No one can invest in an elephant.
No, it's not the same as Apple and traders aren't sharing stuff on Wall Street, but it's just a different way to get people thinking about the environment and sort of what we can do to protect it, I guess.
It's an interesting thought experiment for sure. Amit, what did you learn this week?
I learned that we didn't start using the word orange to refer to the colour until the 1540s. So before that, it was referred to as red or yellow red. So that's why people with orange hair are called redheads, even though their hair obviously isn't red. And why we call the birds red robins, despite the fact that if you look at them, they're actually orange.
Are robins orange, though?
Look it up.
I challenge that.
Do a Google image search right now. I dare you.
Me clacking away my keyboard isn't you dare me. Okay, I'll do it quietly while Natasha tells us what she learned this week.
I learned that this week marks the 100th anniversary of the word robot. The word was first coined by Czech intellectual Karel Čapek in a play called RUR, which is short for Rossum's Universal Robots, which was about unwilling slaves of humanity destined to rise up and destroy their makers. The play was a smash hit, and when it was translated, the word robota, which means forced labour in Czech, was introduced into the English language as robot.
Very, very strong etymology facts there. Love that. Amit,
Thank you
were right to dare me. Robins are in fact orange. I feel like I've been living a lie my whole life, but thank you for helping me see the true nature of robins, I guess. Thank
you. The scales have fallen from your eyes. You've taken the orange pill.
I learned this week that 10% of gamers would rather their homes be destroyed than lose their game save data, which is a bit curious, really, when you think that most of that data is stored in the cloud, and it would be fairly terrible for you to lose your home and all of your belongings versus losing where you'd got to in Zelda or Civilizations. But maybe I'm just not into games enough. If you class yourself as a gamer and you would happily see your home destroyed before you lost your prized game save data, then email podcast@wired.co.uk. How many things would you destroy so that you could keep playing your beloved video game from where you left off? Let us know. podcast@wired.co.uk. Our first story this week, talking of destroying things, is about WeWork and its more than concerning financials, Natasha.
Yeah, so earlier this month, WeWork's chief executive, Sandeep Mathrani, gave a rather extraordinary interview. He said that WeWork is going to aim for a new IPO and that the company is on track for profitability by Q4 2021. Now, for the people that have been paying attention to the company in the past year or so, this sounds like a rather ridiculous thing to say. After all, we're in the midst of a global pandemic that has sent office workers home. There's no date to return to the office. And when we do, companies are likely to want to reduce their office space to accommodate a hybrid workforce. None of this is good news for WeWork, whose bread and butter is selling high-cost office space in swanky locations with perks for the employees that work there. So we decided to take a look at the state of WeWork and whether the figures back up Mathrani's bold statements.
Now, for someone like me who, you know, probably only pays attention to WeWork when they break into the main news cycle for you know, their founder doing something ridiculous, what kind of shape were they in entering this crisis? I know there was a lot of stuff around Adam Neumann a while back, but for people who haven't been paying attention, how prepared was WeWork going into the pandemic?
Yeah, so despite having really big name investors like SoftBank bankrolling its operations, this pandemic has been no walk in the park for WeWork. The company was already in crisis mode, and the pandemic has done nothing but exacerbate the cash flow problem that already existed. But to explain what happened, we have to look back to 2019, when the company first tried to IPO. Now, if everything had gone according to plan, the shared office provider would be busy spending between $3 billion and $4 billion raised in a blockbuster public listing. Banks would have granted the company a further $6 billion in loans if the IPO had been successful. So it would have spent 2020 getting its house in order and using that money raised to try to reach profitability. But that is basically the opposite of what has happened. In a rather public sort of takedown, within the space of a few weeks, that IPO was shelved. WeWork had dropped to less than half of its pre-IPO value, and its controversial founder, Adam Neumann, who was known as much for his love of marijuana and partying as he was for buying real estate, was gone. But the company's accounts for 2019, which were published at the beginning of January 2021, so earlier this month, show just how much trouble it was in. So despite this rampant expansion making global revenues almost double from $1.8 billion to $3.5 billion. The business saw losses balloon in 2019. So these losses widened from $1.7 to $3.9 billion, which is an increase of 129%. So those losses were growing at a faster rate than its income. Now, bear with me. This same picture was replicated in its UK arm, which is called WeWork International, where despite rental income almost doubling from £35.8 million to £68.4 million, the losses for 2019 more than tripled to £231.7 million. So again, this is like an absolutely catastrophic situation for a company that relies on income from rentals not coming in throughout 2020. WeWork's ability to burn through cash has always, you know, made it look a little bit like a dangerous investment. By 2019, the company controlled 528 buildings across 111 cities in 29 countries, right? According to its website, the fact that the public listing fell through and all of this has happened doesn't actually slow WeWork's pace down. As of November 2020, it controlled 859 buildings, which, you know, is a big growth from 528, across 151 cities in 38 countries. Although Mathrani told Reuters that his streamlining had led to WeWork exiting over 100 locations. So we're looking at a company that, despite massive losses, despite a failed IPO, has continued its pace of sort of gobbling up bits of real estate across the world, and it's basically adding to the losses of its bottom line. So in short, WeWork spent 2020 hemorrhaging cash on rents and Adam Neumann's $7.7 million a month payoff rather than getting its house in order. The plan to stabilise the business by making thousands of people redundant was completely blown out of the water by a pandemic which turned its global offices into ghost towns.
It's not the greatest situation for a company to find itself in, but also it's not entirely unexpected. A lot of startups, particularly gig economy startups, and WeWork is kind of in that kind of form. They burn through a lot of cash. They need to scale. They feel they need to scale really, really quickly and become the dominant force in the market. Now, WeWork's problem was that even before the pandemic, it wasn't doing that particularly successfully. Then the pandemic came along, removed all of its ability to make any money, pretty much. So now it's going into 2021. No one's in offices. It's still got hundreds and hundreds of buildings to manage across the world. It's still not profitable. It's still nowhere near an IPO. How does WeWork survive?
Yeah, you paint a very bleak picture, James, but it's accurate. There is a fundamental flaw in WeWork's business, which that it's built on signing really long, expensive leases on space that it rents out in a multitude of very short-term deals. And so that has exposed it to a near ruinous level of risk. And that risk has become existential after a year in which a large proportion of the company's members have just picked up and left. So figures provided by WeWork show that its total membership fell by 11% in the third quarter of 2020 alone. So in order to stem the losses from this and try to recover some of those losses and turn around 2021, Mathrani would have to address that fundamental flaw in WeWork's strategy, which is an over-reliance on freelancers and startups whose year-long contracts can be broken after 6 months, rather than larger corporates, which are known as enterprise clients by WeWork, who have to keep paying for unused office space right through the pandemic. So at the time of the proposed IPO, if you look at the state of the business, around 40% of WeWork's members fell into the latter category, so enterprise clients who had to pay no matter what. By the third quarter of 2020, that figure had risen to 54%. Though that change is only partly due to the company's success in attracting new clients. I mean, yes, it would help that, you know, Deloitte, for example, signed a deal for 35,000 square feet of office space in Manchester City Centre. But the overall percentages have also been skewed by the loss of so many smaller clients who have left. So 54% looks like a growth from 40%. But if you look at the amount of other people who have left, it's actually just a larger percentage of the overall whole rather than an actual growth in of itself. And those large corporate clients that they're trying to attract aren't exactly flocking to WeWork to plug the gap in the middle of this pandemic. Also, WeWork hasn't really done a lot to ingratiate itself to many of its renters during this crisis. Now, WeWork says it was able to offer concessions to the overwhelming majority of member businesses that have requested one. So basically saying, you can't pay, we'll try to give you a break, that's fine. But during the pandemic, the company's actually been accused of profound hypocrisy over its appointment of debt collectors to pursue customers at the same time as the shared office provider is negotiating with its own landlords to try to get out of liabilities to pay its own leases. So the experts our reporter Margaret Taylor spoke to said that WeWork would likely lose at least a third of its revenue from renters whose six-month leases expired during the pandemic and were not renewed. WeWork did not provide projections on its financial performance for the full year, but said that global income for the third quarter of 2020, which are the latest figures that they have, was down by 13% from $934 million to $811 million. So as if you think about that, so you've got the eye-watering losses on the one side, but then if we delve into the company accounts for 2019, it shows an even bleaker picture for the UK, which is one of the key markets for WeWork. The UK arm was balance sheet insolvent at the close of that year, as its net liabilities ballooned from 75.3 million in 2018 to 290.4 million. So a note in the 2019 accounts, which again were released earlier this month, says that the global business for WeWork has confirmed its willingness and ability to provide ongoing financial support, effectively propping up the UK business for a period of at least 12 months from the date of approval of the financial statements, which all sounds very technical, but basically means we'll bail out the UK arm of WeWork for basically the next 12 months at least until this crisis passes. Now, WeWork claims it does have the money to do this. It claims its balance sheet remains strong, with approximately $3.6 billion of cash and unfunded cash commitments until at the end of Q3. Mithrani has had some success in adding to that cash pot by basically putting in place a plan to lay off massive amounts of staff, so thousands of people that have been laid off throughout this crisis, and as a result of the amendment of the leases, which were mentioned by Mithrani, which reduced its long-term lease liabilities by $1.5 billion. So this basically meant that they tried to shave off as many leases as they could without it proving to be impossible for WeWork to support. Tried to get out of as many of them as possible, but carrying on expanding all the time. All of this, of course, all these Q3 figures saying we've got a pot of $3.6 billion of cash was in Q3 of 2020. This was even before a lot of countries were sending people home for second and third lockdowns. In its 2019 accounts, WeWork made a point of saying that COVID-19 was likely to have a negative impact on its 2020 results. But this crisis is spreading into 2021, and the numbers do not support the proclamation of it breaking even this year.
So there's obviously a lot going on here, but at the end of the day, a lot of people in particularly UK, which is going to be a market which is very important, as you say, but also other countries as well where WeWork is big, are going to be working from home for quite a while over the next year. There's probably a good chance that many people won't return to offices till maybe the middle of this year or even later. So to make WeWork's plan a reality, where does it have to turn to really actually be able to sort of enact this?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. It's very difficult to know. If you don't have enough of a pot of money by the end of all this crisis, it's going to be very difficult for them to say, yes, we'll break even by Q4 at all. The only logical place for WeWork to turn to kind of plug those gaps and make sure that what Mithrani says isn't just a load of hot air is to turn to the investors who helped push WeWork to where it is right now. Now, there's still a problem there. There's obviously a fly in the ointment at every turn for WeWork, because it has fewer friends than ever before after this failed IPO. So Fidelity Investments, which is an early investor whose Contra fund bought $18 million of WeWork shares in 2015, has not mentioned the business at all after being forced to write down its investment by 35% at the end of 2019. While last year, Baltimore-based T. Rowe Price made the highly unusual move of publicly lambasting WeWork. So in a filing to the US Securities and Exchange Commission, the fund house says its WeWork investment had been a debacle and a terrible investment that had caused outsized headaches and disappointments. We tried to speak to a spokesperson for this article, and they said, actually, we said everything we wanted to about WeWork. So I suppose that love story ends there. But when it comes to WeWork's lenders, really the game isn't about about, you know, T. Rowe Price, or in fact any other kind of smaller fund that might have invested at the time of the IPO, that the story is really about Japan's SoftBank, which has provided more than $11 billion of debt finance to the company and owns 80% of its shares. It's basically the only show in town, if you think about it. But their long-standing relationship has somewhat soured since WeWork's poor performance pushed the conglomerate's own financials into the red. Last year, SoftBank actually pulled out of an agreement to buy $3 billion worth of WeWork shares from early investors, including its former chief executive, Adam Neumann. This is a decision that's ended up in court. It was completely fraught, fought over in different headlines. You saw a lot of coverage of people basically fighting, saying you've got to do it, them saying we're not going to do it, and so on and so forth. This is going to be a long-running saga. It does show that its patience, though, the patience of SoftBank, which is now trying to cut losses on many of its other investments as well, may have reached its limits. So really, when you think about Mathrani's big proclamations of we're going to plan for a second IPO, we're going to break even in the next year, he's put in some legwork to try to fix the woes of this shared office giant and make that happen. But the figures that we have seen ultimately show that more drastic measures need to be taken for it to survive. It needs to persuade SoftBank to reach its hand into its pocket and, you know, plug some of the gaps. And it needs to show really just a massive U-turn, the likes of which we would have never seen before, in order to fix the financial woes that it is. And for it to survive, to see this very promised post-coronavirus golden age of co-working.
The fundamental problem with WeWork, if I understand it correctly, is that you can't run a real estate business like this. It sort of took the startup move fast and break things mentality of the early 2000s and tried to apply it to real estate, where you're exposed to huge risks because you're signing very, very expensive contracts on things that are made of bricks and mortar that you can't get out of.
And this is the thing about statements like the one Mathrani made earlier this month. It is quite surprising because it does sound like something that Adam Neumann would say rather than something a more conservative leader would say. And this is the thing. You think about WeWork's model, and yes, it has huge fundamental flaws, which they could technically fix. But the question is, could they fix this and fix all of the legacy woes and the financial problems that they've accumulated over the years to then see in this new age of co-working, which supposedly is going to feed into WeWork's model? It's kind of ironic that we're looking down the barrel of, like, in the next few months, hopefully, if things go according to plan, a hybrid workforce that will look for co-working spaces like the ones that WeWork was offering, specifically because that's the way we want to work in the future. It would be highly ironic if WeWork weren't to live to see that happen. But it does seem like the figures at the moment, unless something has happened, which it might be top secret, you never know. Unless something's happening in the background that nobody knows about, these figures just kind of spell out a bit of a kind of it's such a different picture from what Mathrani is painting that you wonder what kind of, you know, delusion might be going on with either the market or the way that they think this strategy works. Look, I have no reason to think that Mathrani and his team aren't able to turn around WeWork, but the figures here just don't support what he's saying. And that's what it boils down to. You wonder exactly, you know, how one could even support the idea of a second IPO if you have not only nothing to back up that statement, but also a legacy of kind of over-promising and under-delivering. So I wish him the best of luck, but what we found doesn't really support what he's saying.
The numbers for WeWork have rarely added up. Podcast.wired.co.uk, are you a resident in a WeWork? Is it the sort of place that you'd be looking to head to when we do return to the offices in a more hybrid model? Is it a business that deserves to survive, given how badly it's been run and how many people it's let down over its short and very exciting life? Podcast.wired.co.uk with your thoughts on that or anything else that we talk about on the show this week. And of course, we'll include a link to the exhaustive report we did on WeWork in the show notes. Our second story this week, Matt Burgess, a couple of weeks ago, you set yourself the unenviable task of trying to get the truth out of North Korea. How did you get on?
Yeah, it's been a testing couple of weeks. But yeah, as you sort of alluded to there, James, I've been reporting a bit around what has happened in North Korea during the pandemic and sort of like the situation, as much as we can sort of ascertain what it's like there. And before I go into those details, just I think it's worth just sort of like reiterating a little bit of context about how different North Korea is as a country to the rest of the world, and in particular sort of the Western democracies that we live in, and many probably of our listeners live in as well. So just for that added picture, because I think it is worth considering this all has an impact on its pandemic response overall. So North Korea is still one of the most repressive and totalitarian regimes in the world. People generally don't have freedom of movement around the country, and it's not uncommon for sort of forced internal resettlement to happen. Emigration is illegal, and all foreign travel is controlled by the government, which sees people defecting or being refugees from the country on a fairly frequent basis, and yeah, going and living abroad in some cases when they can. And while people, just for instance, while people do have some mobile phone services, calls and text messages are monitored by surveillance agencies within the country, and smartphone users don't have access to the global internet. You can't just get out your phone and tap in Google and go and look at what the pandemic is like all around the world or anywhere. And tied to that, information is very much controlled by the government, and all the media is state-run media. There's no independent, democratically produced journalism or anything like that. It's all very much coming out of the state propaganda units. And this just like feeds into the larger array of potential human rights issues across the country. The country is very much sanctioned through economic and trade issues by the UN and other countries around the world for its insistence and continuing to create a nuclear program and develop nuclear weapons. And over the last year as well, there have been large flooding in North Korea over sort of 2020, which has heightened some of the food supply issues. So overall, it is obviously a very unpleasant state to live in for many people there, and they don't know any different or what the rest of the world is like overall.
It's a global pandemic. Barely any part of the world has been spared, and there were early predictions that a country like North Korea, with an appalling health infrastructure and all of these other problems with famine and totalitarianism, it would really, really struggle if COVID-19 got in. It also shares a border with China. But so far, we haven't heard much about how the pandemic has hit North Korea, both because it's quite good at keeping secrets, but also there are vague suspicions that maybe COVID-19 hasn't hit North Korea that hard. So what do we know?
So officially, North Korea has recorded no cases of COVID-19 and also no deaths. Weekly reports that are produced by the World Health Organization for the Southeast Asia region show that people are being tested in North Korea using PCR tests, and those are being analyzed in 15 different laboratories. But all of the tests that have been done have come back negative. As of January the 8th, which was the most recent date for the figures were available at the time of reporting the story, there have been 26,000 people or 26,000 samples tested from North Korea from 13,000 people, and all of those have come back negative. And sort of looking at a few of the most recent weekly reports, around sort of like 700 North Koreans out of a population of 25 million are being tested every week. And these are figures that it reports to the World Health Organization. The World Health Organization, in its own report, says all points of entry into the country are shut. And all of the people I spoke to for this piece, which largely includes people that are working at NGOs and journalists and also sort of watchers and analysts of North Korea, sort of doubt these claims a little bit that there have been zero cases in the country. I mean, as you pointed out, James, there is a border with China. China was one of the first places, was the first place where the pandemic sort of emerged from. China is one of the biggest sort of drivers of tourism and trade within North Korea. So there is a lot of doubt being cast on that. That's not to say that there is necessarily an epidemic going on within North Korea. One of the big things things is we don't know what is actually happening other than these figures that it has reported. But we do know that North Korea acted very quickly in its response to the pandemic, and it wasn't even a technically classified as a pandemic at that time, but on January 22nd, 2020, so more than a year ago, North Korea shut its borders with China and Russia, which stopped the tourism and trade coming from China when it is allowed, and obviously placed greater burdens on people being able to leave. Those that could leave for various internet were permitted to leave, could no longer do so. And since then, the borders have not opened. So it's been more than a year when the borders have been fully shut. Border security has been increased and larger sort of buffer zones have been placed around the border with China to stop people crossing. And overall, this is a little bit more extreme than any other country, particularly given the context of North Korea being shut down largely anyway, normally. And the sort of like border restrictions also extend to sort of its international into the waters that it owns, and it sort of shut and stopped people going into waters. And in September, the country was forced to apologize after South Korea said it had shot and burned the body of a South Korean official who had strayed into North Korean waters, and North Korea apologized for that. And there've also been reports from intelligence officials around the world of sort of shoot to kill policies for people going towards the borders altogether.
So, I mean, as you outlined at the start, like a lot of the things that we are missing out on, like international travel and things like that, are things that are almost impossible for North Koreans generally in their day-to-day lives, even before the pandemic. What has the impact been on, from the people you've spoken to? What sense do you get of what the impact has been on the people living there during the pandemic, and what it is likely to be like if there is, in fact, an outbreak, and if the case numbers are wrong that we're hearing?
Yeah, it's a good point, and to caveat that, and it will come onto this a little bit further on, it's some of what is going on is a mystery, but from people that are in the know about this, we generally know that while North Korea has a purported universal healthcare system, it isn't reliably accessible to a lot of people all the time. So studies have found that the country's universal healthcare system has large disparities, and that many people struggle to obtain healthcare from the state, particularly those that are considered in the lower classes. So one of the people that we spoke to for this, who's been watching the country very closely and has sort of greater knowledge on this, says that most people generally don't have access to hand sanitizers or soaps, much less PPE, and many people do live in very close quarters. The accommodation and housing that is provided and available is can often be cramped and sort of like very much lots of people nearby, which are obviously, not knowing what we know about how coronavirus spreads, ideal conditions for controlling an epidemic if one was to exist in the country. And the people that I've been speaking to are very worried about sort of like how the pandemic has potentially made life worse for the people living in North Korea overall. And one way that we can sort of glimpse at least what the country is saying and telling people is through its state published media, which is some of which is accessible to the outside world when it's made available, and has been sort of observed by lots of different groups looking at this overall. And the large message, or a couple of messages coming from North Korean state media, has been that the country has been very keen to say it's been doing very well, and it's also pointed out the spiraling death count around the world. When one city was locked down in the autumn last year, party propaganda said the state had established a strict and flawless anti-epidemic measure to keep the city locked down, even though the case that was allegedly being investigated there was never confirmed to happen. And in November, one of the country's newspapers said that the country must maintain an ironclad barrier. One of the things that people I spoke to said is that the country's it has told its citizens that of the dangers of the pandemic, and that it has been very sort of upfront and unusual, one person said, in a way of explaining what is going on and some information about the virus. But also on the sort of like on the flip side of that, it's also been very paranoid, and people said that it's sort of overreacted in some ways to the pandemic. So it's warned that smokers are of a higher risk of contracting COVID-19, and that migratory birds or even snowfall could potentially spread the virus. And one report by an independent organization that reports on North Korea, NK News, said when When it was talking about the potential of snow transmitting the virus, the advice given to people was to wear masks and glasses and a cap outside to protect themselves, but generally to stay away from the snow. So, there's been a lot of different messages coming out of the government.
So if the country is pumping out all this propaganda and says there have been no cases, we know that the borders have closed, we know there have been cases in cities, people reporting, you know, people living in cramped circumstances. Obviously, North Korea isn't exactly a bubble, so that there are likely to be cases. But who do you actually, how do you get information? Who do you believe in all of this? Because it must be difficult to know what exactly is happening if there's no one on the ground to necessarily report it.
Exactly, yeah. And this is one of the biggest challenges around reporting around North Korea, and not just for journalists, but anybody sort of watching the country and sort of like internationally as well. And as we said, sort of the border being closed is one of the big issues about sort of getting information out of North Korea. So normally a lot of ways that we get information about what's happening on the ground in normal times is by people defecting or leaving the country and then sort of going, most cases traveling through China and into South Korea, where they are then sort of treated and speak to NGOs and groups that are sort of like sort of help to sort of acclimatize them to sort of life outside of North Korea. And because of the border closures, there's been a dramatic decrease in the amount of people leaving North Korea. So recent figures that were published from South Korea show that just 229 people entered South Korea from the north in 2020, which is an all-time low. In 2019, the figure stood at 1,047. A few years ago, it was in the 2,000s, 3,000s. And a lot of the people that did enter South Korea in 2020 also may have left North Korea before 2020 and before the pandemic, because the amount of time it takes to travel and get to South Korea overall. So this is a key source of our understanding of what happens in North Korea, and it's basically been limited because of the borders closing. And also humanitarian groups and foreign diplomats have all left the country, basically, because of various reasons, political reasons, and also just sort of other barriers to sort of working there at the moment. So those sources of information about what normally happens in Korea haven't come out, and it really means that what happens on the ground is remaining a bit of a mystery. There are unanswered questions about potential outbreaks. There have been 30 odd thousand people that have been put into quarantine in North Korea. We don't know the sort of like the detailed on the conditions that they were in. And also there's questions about medical supplies, which are often sort of provided through humanitarian aid and other groups that way. So one thing that we do know, though, is that the vaccine is the country wants the vaccine. So North Korean hackers have been identified to have been attempting to break into some of the producers of the vaccine and try and get information about it. But also the country has been quietly asking for help through programs which help have been put in place to help low-income and poor countries get the vaccine. But one of the things, though, is this could last a long time. So it's analysis has sort of estimated that it might be 2022 or 2023 until North Korea gets any vaccine at a large scale, which is a long time to be living in these extended lockdown conditions and sort of more isolated than North Korea is even in normal times from the world.
And concerns that the North Korea watchers that you spoke to, one thing that came up was the knock-on effect of this, that life in North Korea is already incredibly difficult and people are controlled by a regime that is absolutely brutal. That's likely, we're fairly sure, has increased dramatically during the pandemic as North Korea tries to control the potential of any outbreak. But from the people that you were speaking to, there's a risk that that extra level of control and reduction in liberty continues, not just until the people are vaccinated, but for a long time to come if the state sees a benefit in it.
Yeah, definitely. So there are potential few longer term impacts. So one result of a lot of the propaganda that people I was speaking to were saying is that this could be a political gain for the regime. They've seen large death tolls from other countries and things like that, and then within North Korea led to believe, and as far as we know, there have been zero cases or deaths. So that obviously looks very good from a sort of like internal political perspective. But in terms of the broader picture, yeah, there are concerns that people have around sort of, yeah, if these conditions become normalized and the country can, to some extent, survive and isn't impacted in too many big ways on a sort of international scale, then maybe these harsher conditions will become the new normal, to use a phrase that we've used a lot of times. So still to be seen, but it seems that conditions, and people are concerned about conditions for normal people living there, the human toll may be worse than it already was.
Absolutely. And as you say, if it is true that there have been no cases and no deaths, or at least a very low number of them, then that really does strengthen North Korean propaganda and give the country the ability to argue that its way of doing things is the right way of doing things, which is an incredibly powerful tool in a state that is often seen as on the verge of collapse. Final story this week, bit of a change of gear, Amit. It's about stupid advertising. Tell us more.
Always bringing the hard-hitting stories to the podcast from the culture section. Yeah, so in the before times when we could go on trains and, you know, to tube stations and stuff, you might have noticed a design trend overtaking some of the adverts, or you might have even noticed it on your lockdown walks on, you know, bus stations and billboards. So these are adverts which are very flat, very geometric, very figurative. They've got lots of blocks of solid colours and kind of strange human-like figures with bendy arms and, you know, no facial features. You guys know what I'm talking about, right? These kind of colourful, bright, kind of fairly vacuous adverts that have just been everywhere. So they've been used by companies ranging from Money Farm to the train line to the Viagra delivery service Get Eddy. They're being used by brands like Slack, Salesforce, Robinhood, WeTransfer, all using the same style, as do many of their competitors. They've become a bit of a trope in the design world, and they've been dubbed Corporate Memphis. This design style has been dubbed Corporate Memphis, and it's starting to get on designers' nerves.
Why on earth is this happening? Why would all of these very, very different companies want to put up adverts that not just look the same, but look rubbish?
Yeah, so I guess you have to put yourself in the mindset of a new startup. So say you know, you've just founded a startup and you're reinventing mortgages, or, you know, revolutionizing insurance, or disrupting the world of, you know, whatever it might be, and you've got an app and a website, and you're about to roll out your first big marketing campaign, and you need to come up with a visual identity that represents what your company is all about. And obviously it needs to be fun, because, you know, you're not like those big old companies that have been dominant in the sector for years. You know, you're doing something fresh and different, and it needs to be inclusive. You know, you want everyone to be able to see themselves in the design. You don't want to focus on a particular type of person or group of people. You want it to be kind of as vague as possible to appeal to the widest group of people. But the main concern is that most of all, it needs to be kind of cheap, and it needs to be versatile, so that you can use it small in newspaper ads, but you can also use it kind of blown up to the size of a billboard and a tube station. Now, corporate Memphis designs, the designs of the type I was talking about earlier, they're quite inoffensive. They're quite easy to pull off. You know, and while they've kind of started off in the kind of the startup world and, you know, tech marketing and UX design, the trend is now consuming the visual world at large.
So if this is something that is pretty simple, why are designers and others involved in this world so upset about its use?
So partly it's because it's led to this kind of massive homogenization of the internet's visual culture, is how one person we spoke to put it. So, you know, if every company has the same branding, then websites will start to look the same, and the internet goes from being quite a kind of vibrant, different, quirky place where, you know, I mean, remember in the 90s when you'd get like kind of neon flashing lights and things like that when you went, or like auto playing music. I'm not saying we should go back to that world, but, you know, you don't want every website to look exactly the same, or every company to look the same. And then the second problem is that kind of shady companies, so one designer we spoke to talked about letting agents in his hometown, are starting to use the design tropes to project a kind of fun, friendly image that they don't deserve. So Claire Evans, who's been collecting examples of corporate Memphis since 2018, says that it makes the big tech companies look friendly, approachable, and concerned with human-level interaction and community, which is largely the opposite of what they really are. So it's this kind of false sense that they're projecting, and that's what's really got designers upset.
That name, Corporate Memphis, where did that come from? I mean, is it a reference to the location? Is that a place where big tech companies are friendly, approachable, and concerned with human level interaction. Oh no.
No, it's actually nothing to do with the city. No, it's named after an Italian design and architecture group called Memphis, which was big in the 80s and which kind of popularized this idea of kind of bright and colorful designs, which were kind of ran counter to the sort of, you know, design aesthetic of the, you know, 1980s and the decades around then, when it was kind of all quite brutal and functional. But the kind of current trend grew out partly out of a change that Apple made to its design way back in 2013. So before 2013, Apple's iOS operating system was very skeuomorphic. So that means it was designed to mimic real world objects. So I don't know if you remember what the icon for the Notes app used to look like on an iPhone, but it looked like a real notepad, and it had a kind of had like the rings at the top and like other things, like the contacts book had like a leather effect on it on the app on iPhone and things like that, with like lifelike shading and textures. But then in 2013, Apple had this like big redesign where they dropped all these kind of skeuomorphic elements in favor of a more flattened, simplified user interface. So that's one strand to it. And then at the same time, tools like Adobe Illustrator, which made it easy to design kind of flat vector images with clean lines and clean colors, they became much more accessible to people just because computing power came cheaper. It's, you know, your laptop's much more capable of running Illustrator today than one you bought 10 years ago would have been. And then also image banks kind of full of vector images sprung up online. So sites like FreePick and Undraw meant that even users with no design background could download shapes and, you know, turn them into whatever they wanted to. And then the name Corporate Memphis, yeah, comes from that Italian design group. It was coined by a guy called Mike Merrill, who was working in advertising when he kind of started to notice this deja vu effect of like flat, bright designs. Now, Merrill says that he's recognized that there are basically two kind of different types of company that are using Corporate Memphis. So there's like smaller companies that are engaging in what he calls pattern matching. So they kind of want to look cool and fun and different. So they kind of mimic the approach of startups that have succeeded in the past that are kind of cool and fun and different. I mean, you can see this in the branding of like Challenger Banks, right? And how they all kind of have coalesced around this sort of, you know, hey, we're, you know, young and hip and we drink, you know, Oatly and all this kind of stuff, right? And so that's one aspect of it. And then the other aspect of it is the bigger tech companies that do it in a quite a cynical way. And the IPO level tech companies use the same style because they want to look cooler and smaller and more nimble than they actually are, and because it's lazy and because it's safe.
It's weird, isn't it, that we've got this huge umbrella of companies, from small startups to companies trying to go for several billion dollars on an IPO, and they all want to look the same. And is this partly because these companies want to look like they stand for something? You know, all the companies that people really, really relate to and that do deliver value for consumers, they stand for something, and they're able to convey what they stand for in their advertising, and it's really core to what they are. You know, people love those brands, whereas no one really loves a company that's reinventing mortgages that they've never heard of. So for those small startups, it's kind of lazy and a bit of a way of hiding. But what's the bigger problem here? Why does it really matter if we've got, I mean, you can see these companies coming a mile off. It doesn't really feel like there's anything particularly wrong with it. It's just lazy and a bit uninteresting, no?
Yeah, so the argument that designers make, and I don't know the extent to which I actually personally agree with this. I'm skeptical the extent to which the design choices have this effect on us. But what influential designer David Rudnick told us is that what makes Corporate Memphis particularly insidious is that its worldview is misleading. So it kind of depicts the world as this sort of simple place. It oversimplifies things with a kind of limited color palette, a lack of depth, and offers a uniquely uncomplicated view of the world. There's a particular variant of Corporate Memphis that uses a visual technique called isometric projection. So it gives the viewer a slightly elevated perspective to create, you know, like a high street or a row of houses or something like that in the picture. And this is interesting, he says, because there's no vanishing point, so it eliminates the variable of time within these images. So he's saying that this type of design is popular with fintech and mortgage companies because they have a benefit for playing down the passage of time. If you're taking out a loan that you're going to be paying off for the next 25 or 35 years, then in your imagery, if you can play down the idea that, you know, time is passing with the kind of subtle design cues that you use, then that's of benefit to the company. But more generally, like, It's about, yeah, the way the companies project themselves, or the way they want to be seen versus how they actually are. You know, they allow these companies to offer an illusion of a world without hierarchies, where everything is equal and everyone's, you know, the same, and we're all kind of in this kind of flat, colourful world, and everything's friendly and, you know, nice. And it's very much at odds with the way that the kind of CEOs of tech companies talk in private. You know, it's this, the internal Silicon Valley jargon of, you know, tech bros and, you know, disruption and constant fighting between competitors and, you know, driving the change and, you know, sparking the revolution and all this kind of stuff. It is very much at odds with the way they project themselves as sort of friendly and colourful and flat. And I think that's the real problem that designers have with it, is this false image that they're presenting.
You wouldn't really have thought of it looking at an advert for someone promising a revolutionary new approach to mortgages. But it's interesting, right? If people are making risky financial decisions, be it, you know, mortgaging themselves up to the eyeballs or investing in a way that they wouldn't necessarily have done so before, an advert that makes it look like something simple could be not dangerous, but misleading, and could lead people down the wrong path, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think... I'm not sure whether, I mean, if you look up things like Klarna or like Wonga or things like that, you know, these are companies that are massively exploitative in terms of the interest rates they charge and the services they offer, but they're kind of presented as like, you know, your mate or, you know, a friend or a friend who's just helping you out with a bit of cash, you know, to tide you over to your next paycheck. And actually, no, these companies are as problematic as the big companies. Often they're owned by the big companies, you know. Often they're you know, Morgan Stanley's got like an investment app that's got some name and you'd never know they were linked, right? And it's often the same companies pulling the strings, but using the kind of imagery of tech startups to present themselves in a way that's more palatable to average users or to people that want to be seen as cool and hip and you know, supporting the little guy.
The story of corporate Memphis, it's absolutely fascinating. You've seen it everywhere, even if you're barely leaving the house. You've still definitely seen it. Now you know what it is and why it might not be as simple as it seems. Podcast at wired.co.uk with your thoughts on that story or anything else that we've talked about on the podcast this week or any other week if you're listening back through the archives. Time for one of your emails now. Matt Burgess, you've been rummaging through the inbox.
Yeah, and we had an email from Maya and Boris, which says, "Me and my husband love your podcast. Every time the intro and outro music plays, we dance around pretending it's a little party with you guys." They go on to say that, however, over the last 3 or 4 episodes, the outro music has been cropped, which makes them slightly sad. And they said, "Can we not crop the outro music? Because there's not many occasions to party these days." So yeah, we will make sure that that is not cropped off or anything at the end of the podcast now. And I mean, it might even be playing as I'm speaking.
It should be. If you've edited the podcast correctly, it should be the backing track beneath our voices right now. It's rare that we get people emailing in saying that they like the podcast music. Mostly it's people saying, why haven't you changed your podcast music in 502 episodes? Well, it's still here and it will probably be here for some while yet. So we're glad that some of you like it. podcast@wired.co.uk. We love getting your emails. Please do write in and let us know what's on your mind. Thanks for listening and we will see you again next week. Take care. Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.